This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Before the war started, oil was worth $65 a barrel, and it had been there for 2 years. That's what it's fundamentally worth. And that's what it's going to be worth again at some point after Trump decides he's had enough of Iran.
If you're still driving a combustion engine vehicle, you've probably noticed that within a matter of weeks, the price of gas has increased by about a third, courtesy of the illegal war being waged on Iran by the U.S. and Israel. This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome returning guest and oil expert Daniel Dicker to get an inside perspective on the latest spike in the global price of oil. We discuss the impact the high prices have on the renewable energy industry, ponder how it could affect U.S. domestic oil producers, and examine how the Trump administration's manipulation of markets has made oil a very risky commodity to trade. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Dicker. Dan is a longtime energy trader, oil expert, and is now in the aviation space. Dan, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
So before we start, tell us what has changed in your career.
Well, it's funny. I feel like, you know, Lloyd Bridges in Airplane. You know, it's like I picked the wrong week to stop sniffing glue. You remember that line?
Absolutely.
Oil was flat for 3 years because basically supplies had stabilized and so had demand for a number of reasons we could talk about. But, you know, it came to the point where after 3 years of, you know, telling my subscribers very little, I mean, what could I tell them? You know, we make money as oil traders on volatility, and the volatility is kind of drained out of oil until, you know, Trump decided to find the one way to make oil go crazy again. And that was to start bombing Iran for no good reason. But I had shut down the Energy Word, you know, right in, you know, late November. And, you know, this all started about a month ago. So, but it doesn't change the fact that I still follow the business.
So if you look at some of these recent oil spikes of the 20th century, you'll see generally it's something to do with the Middle East or a conflagration of some sort. I remember 2012 when we first spoke, I believe it was Syria. Even though that's not a big oil country, there was concern about oil supplies in the Middle East when the Arab Spring was happening. And so oil jumped over $100 a barrel. And then we had in 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, there was also supply issues and we saw oil spike. And now here we are back in 2026 with another spike where it's over $100 a barrel. Are these spikes just spikes?
Well, I had come to the opinion, you know, before this that we would never see $100 oil again. You know, other technologies, particularly solar and wind, were, you know, impinging upon the global energy portfolio to such a degree that, you know, the necessity for, you know, fast development of fossil fuel supplies was basically over. That the major growth in energy demand was going to be supplied by those renewables, those sustainable energy technologies. And, you know, that's basically why I shut down the service. I mean, the supplies seem to be, well, not in any way going out of business, seem to be static and, you know, unnecessary to see. But of course, when you have a static supply and you suddenly chop it by 20% overnight, that's going to have a massive effect on prices, and it's going to have a massive instability to economies.
So, Dan, we often look at things like the Dow, the price of oil, the 30-year treasury yield as these benchmarks for economic health in the U.S. economy. But that's kind of a layman's benchmark. What do you look for to gauge whether or not things are looking healthy in the U.S. economy or not?
It's a good question. A lot of my benchmarks have gone, the way the dodo bird, in a lot of ways. I mean, I thought, for a long time that national debt would be a stopping point for growth, and it turned out not to be. I thought that, PEs at a certain point, once they reached, in the high 20s and low 30s, that was, an absolute red flag to ever buy stocks, that they were about to really go down and go down significantly. I thought that interest rates, couldn't sustain themselves at near zero or negative numbers or this low for a long time, and that, as they say, the bond vigilantes would emerge and punish everyone, and that hasn't happened.
And you probably didn't foresee people putting $1.5 billion bets on Kalshi prediction markets right before they bombed Iran either. This new reality of manipulation of the markets is insane.
Or meme stocks, or the latest AI thing, and there's always the latest thing to bet on. But I was a trader who worked in a marketplace where I had small advantages that people outside of that marketplace didn't have. And that means that I was more likely, not I was, guaranteed, but I was more likely to correctly, put a trade on than somebody who was standing with not the information that I had. Now, there's nothing illegal about the information I had. All I was basically doing was I was watching everybody else come into this marketplace, and I could see, and I had a sense of who was big and who was small and where they were moving their money, and you could get some sense of where the market was headed, maybe a little bit better from that. Now we live in an age where it's not just being on the outside where you don't have inside information, where literally there is just transparent, thievery going on, transparent front running of these announcements, these Twitter bleeps from the president of the United States that move the market, spectacularly. And we have records of billions, hundreds of millions of dollars of bets flowing in 30 minutes before one of these announcements, or 45 minutes before one of these announcements. And if you learn anything as a trader, and I've been a trader for 40 some odd years, is you don't play in someone else's sandbox. If somebody else has all the inside information and you're not on the inside, don't play. You're gonna lose. You're just gonna lose. So, in a lot of ways, my position on stocks and oil has been, agnostic, because, like somebody said to me, "Are you gonna get back into the oil game now that it's started to move again?" No, because it's somebody else's sandbox worse than ever. And I have no insight, into how this 7-year-old thinks, and even less, inside information from what he's clearly delivering to his buddies. So, as far as I'm concerned, my best advice to, most people, if you have stocks, buy indexes, buy them for the long haul and forget about them. And for God's sakes, don't bet on oil. Don't. You're just giving your money away.
Just to give some listeners who may not follow the stock market very closely, in 1990, they were talking about how the Dow would never get through 3,000 because it had languished in the 1,000 to 2,500 range for 40 years, right? And then when we hear about the Dow plummeting and people's 401ks being affected by the stock market going from 48,000 to 46,000, this is peanuts in terms of the marginal change that's happening.
What you learn as a trader is the market goes up until buyers stop buying. And that's the only thing that matters. In a lot of ways, oil right now at $100 a barrel is reflecting that better than anything you could imagine. Exactly that. Why buyers are buying and buyers are not buying is affecting the price of oil. And in the opposite way that you'd expect, you'd think that $100 a barrel oil is reflecting a lot of buyers rushing to buy oil. It is, in fact, the opposite. It's a lot of buyers afraid to buy oil right now because, and I will tell you this for a fact, and this is going to go over really, probably like a rock with your listeners, but they should listen very closely because they're not going to hear this from anybody but me, and it's 100% true. So here you go. Here's an exclusive, okay? Oil that's being sold on the street, for example, like cornflakes in a supermarket. If you go in and you want to buy a barrel of oil and you want to put cash down, is selling right now for $160 a barrel. That's what the cash price of oil is. But oil, what we talk about and the way that it's priced in the global marketplace, is not set by people who actually buy and sell it, for cash for physical properties. It's made by traders who are involved in futures markets. And right now, traders in futures markets don't want to buy oil. They don't necessarily want to sell it, but they definitely don't really want to buy it.
Why?
Because at any moment, and I think it's going to be soon, Trump is going to say he's had enough of Iran. He's going to walk out of Iran without any, warning or whatever. And whoever was long oil, whoever had bought oil at $95, $96, $97, is going to wake up the next day with oil at $85, $82. It's going to drop $15 immediately.
And when you buy those futures, you're buying 60, 90 days in the future, so you don't want to get caught with egg on your shoes.
Yes, and even if you could last to the end of, delivery, you probably wouldn't see those kinds of numbers either, because the deliveries, it depends on where you're taking delivery, it's another thing. But that's not important. What's important is you learned that, stocks have a value based on, the earnings that they make. And I learned that oil has a value based on how much people want to buy and how much people want to sell at any particular moment. And that's really what's going on here. I will tell you that fundamentally speaking, when you block 20% of the global supply of oil, that the oil price goes a lot higher than $100 a barrel. It's worth at least $150 a barrel. It's probably worth $200 a barrel. That's how deep a supply problem blocking 20% of the supply is. Why isn't it selling for $200 a barrel? Simply because nobody wants to buy oil at $120 or $140 or $150 a barrel and wake up one morning when Trump decides, he's done everything he can and I'm declaring victory and I'm leaving, and now they're out 40,000 per contract on, and on 10 contracts, that's $500,000, okay?
And then oil would just plummet.
Plummet. It would plummet because fundamentally, before the war started, oil was worth $65 a barrel, and it had been there for 2 years, basically between $65 and $75 a barrel for 2 years. That's what it's fundamentally worth. And that's what it's going to be worth again at some point after Trump decides he's had enough of Iran.
As railhead towns feel the steel mills rust, water froze in the generation. Clear as winter ice, this is your paradise. There ain't no need for ya. There ain't no need for ya. Go straight to hell, boys. Go straight to hell, boys.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to energy expert Daniel Dicker. So, Dan, I saw a little headline about how Japan and Korea are looking at opening up coal plants again because of the tightening of oil. Is this a trend that we're going to see? And what does it mean for people who care about environmental issues?
It's not a trend we're going to see, but here's why this, ultimately, I'm a little more optimistic than a lot of people about what's going on in Iran. The United States has a problem with the Iran war because prices are going up for gasoline. What's not going badly for the Americans is they don't have a supply problem. Okay, so prices are global. No matter where there's a shortage, everybody gets a same global price for energy. But supplies are localized, and the United States has an ample domestic supply of both oil and particularly natural gas. You know who doesn't have an ample domestic supply of either oil or natural gas?
Japan and Korea.
Japan and Korea, all those Asian countries that really get supplied by what's being blockaded by the Strait of Hormuz. So that's why, for example, that Japanese reporter, when the Japanese Prime Minister was in the Oval Office, asked the question, why didn't you tell your allies you were about to bomb Iran? And he came in with this just, embarrassing, response about Pearl Harbor, and surprises, which was really embarrassing. But anyway, the point was the Japanese guy was not asking, why didn't you tell your allies? The Japanese guy was asking, in the presence of the Japanese Prime Minister, why did you feel it was okay to catastrophically risk our economy without giving us the courtesy of a phone call? Because these kinds of energy shortages that are going to hit and have started to hit Japan, Korea, Indonesia, India to a lesser degree, these things will annihilate their economy to a degree that the Americans would never ever feel based on merely a price. A price is one thing, it puts a pressure. But when you have none, when you literally run out, when you can't turn the lights on at any price, that is a different problem. And that's what the Japanese and the Koreans are facing if this goes on for another 2 months. That's what they're facing. That's why they're completely apoplectic in talking about coal right now. But here's the plus side. The plus side is that if Trump does get out, the Japanese and the Koreans and everybody else can go to the Iranians and say, look, I know you want to hurt the United States, but the problem is that you may hurt them, but you're going to destroy us. And we'll pay anything you want for your oil, but we need it now. We need the LNG now. And not only do we need it from Iran, but the Saudis need to sell it because they're a petro state, and the UAE needs to sell it because they're a petro state, and Iraq needs to sell it because they're a petro state. And guess what? The Iranians need to sell it because they're a petro state. And their economies also rely on sales. As much as the Japanese rely on getting those sales, these guys need to sell it. So, in a lot of ways, I think that this may work out, less catastrophically than a lot of people think, because I think the incentives for the Iranians to keep the strait closed will not be as much as the incentives to open it up once the U.S. gets out.
What does this type of disintermediation, which is a fancy word of saying total chaos that the Trump administration is practicing in terms of its foreign policy, this imperialist idea that you can just go in and take their oil, like we see in Venezuela, how does that affect these petrostates? And in your mind, how will it affect their ability to coordinate? Is this the end of the cartel era, or will it just transmogrify into something different, Dan?
I take some, and you may not, my view on what happened in Venezuela was different than probably your listeners was. And that was, yeah, Trump went in there and he thought he could make a little more coin, himself from Venezuelan oil. And what was interesting is that in my mind, the CEO of Exxon and Chevron to a lesser degree, told Trump, to go shove it, basically.
Because this oil was not easy oil like Saudi sweet crude or something.
It didn't even go as far as that. They were sort of like, what, you're not doing anything for me. If I wanted to go in there and drill, I don't need you. I can pay off any dictator I want. And I've been doing it for 50 years. And I don't need you to go in and show me how to do that. Okay? So get out of my face. And don't tell me I'm being, patriotic if I take oil out for you to make money on. If I wanted to be in Venezuela, I'd be there already. And that's, they said it in very kind of, business-like terms, but that's what I heard. And this goes back to, his previous Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. He said he was an effing idiot. And he walked out, and he left. There's not this kind of, oil company, connection with Trump that's, there's a suspicion on all sides. Even the oil companies know that Trump is only out for his own pocketbook And he's not really, I mean, he took $1 billion each from the UAE and Saudi Arabia, and now they can't sell a barrel of oil to save their lives. I don't think this is what they bargained for when they gave him all that money. So again, Trump is not a partner to be relied on. So my feeling on this kind of idea where the United States is running in for oil is it's temporary. The industry, is doesn't trust Trump, to help them out in any way, and are suspicious of it. And I don't think anything in terms of the long-term relationships of cartels and, the motion of petrodollars changes very much after he leaves the scene.
As I walked on through troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Daniel Dicker. He's an energy analyst, former energy trader. So, Dan, we're talking about long term. It's always nice to kind of look at a horizon without the current resident in the White House being there anymore. So, what kind of long term effects do you see this Iranian incursion having on the price of oil 5 years from now? Will this just be a blip, or is this a seismic shift in your estimation?
Not a seismic shift. I think it'll have, longer term consequences. You can't just turn on switches to, retrieve production, build stockpiles back. And then the Iranians are going to want some, retribution, whether that means that they limit the supply, the flow coming out of the straits, because they'll want, a bonus. They'll want a premium built into oil prices for a while, in order to make up for all the stuff that was destroyed and the people that were killed and whatever. And I think that they'll get that. I think that'll be understood as being part of the deal. But 6, 8 months down the road, I see $65 oil again, because that's fundamentally what it's worth. And that's, in terms of, straight demand supply numbers, that's about right. That's about what the petrostates need to sell, and that's about what the OECD and non-OECD, kind of participants kind of need in terms of demand. That's kind of where we are.
One of the real differences between the oil market today and what it was in that first real energy crunch in the 70s is that the US is now the world's largest producer of oil. What does the spike in price mean for domestic production in the fracking industry and the US domestic oil producers?
Well, over the short term, these companies, it's a lifeline, and they're going to make more money for, a couple of quarters. And to be fair, they have had, a very bad stretch over the course of the last couple of years. One recalls, during the pandemic, that demand cratered, and there was a moment when oil was $20 a barrel, and it wasn't a short moment. And it crawled back up from $20 a barrel for a long time. So a lot of these companies went broke, and the ones that hung on, their debt structure was pretty bad. I'm not one of these guys who, when the oil companies make a couple extra nickels, that I'm the guy, oh, these guys are always just stealing from everybody. Nah, they've kind of had a bad time of it themselves for quite a long time, and to some degree, they deserve to recoup some dough. But besides that, I don't see them rushing to create, new production at this point. Again, they know the fundamentals of, you know, how much demand there is out there in a static, you know, an oil environment. And these projects that oil companies embark upon, they have years of, they schedule out for years. So if you wanted to do something, for example, that was, you know, big barrels in the Gulf of Mexico, you plan 5 years in advance for a well that'll deliver oil for 12 years after that. You know, and that's not something you take on based on an oil price that you think is going to, you know, maybe spike for 6-8 months over $100, but then come back to $65. It better be, you know, valuable and make a good ROI, you know, based on $65, $70 crude before you start it, and not depend on those $100 prices sustaining themselves for more than a short period of time.
In terms of renewables, I remember when we first spoke, this was probably 15 years ago, I think you said, we need oil at $150, $200 a barrel for renewables to really take hold and become the 900-pound gorilla in the room. Renewables have come down in price, and they're a significant part of the country's energy portfolio, still on the rise. How has your thinking changed over the last 15 years in terms of the way oil's price affects the ability of renewables to continue their ascension?
Yeah, I mean, and their ascension is assured, and it was back then. The problem was always, and it remains, you know, can we accelerate that? Can we incentivize that? And that was the idea behind my theory, you know, to make oil expensive and incentivize, you know, the quicker turnaround of wind, solar, and geothermal, and so forth. And it's a shame because, you know, we see the, you know, I was listening to Al Gore on he's doing a podcast, and the ground that we've lost on climate change over the course of the last 10 years. I mean, you know, all I can say is I wish oil was expensive 10 years ago and really expensive. And I wish we had accelerated some of these alternatives to greater use. And I think we'd be in a better place right now. And even now, I wish we could accelerate the move towards sustainable energy sources. It's not happening quick enough for me even now, but it is happening and it can't be stopped.
Well, I always appreciate your insights. Dan Dicker, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Come what may, down crooked paths once more. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Melvin Sparks, The Clash, and Sharon Van Etten.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.